The role of human mirror neurons is still debated, but they seem to be a part of the neural structures that allow us to experience a milder version of what others are thinking and feeling. These mirrors in our minds make us smile when someone friendly smiles at us. They make us afraid when others are frightened and cause us to feel pain or joy when others do. As Rizzolatti put it, these mirrors let us grasp the minds of others not through conceptual reasoning, but through direct simulation, by feeling, not by thinking. They are fundamental for our functioning and survival as interdependent social creatures living together in society. The enviable beliefs. If EF is well developed early in life, children have a better chance to construct the lives they want. They have a foundation for building interconnected beliefs about themselves that should rank high on our wish list for those we love. A sense of personal control or mastery reflected in an I think I can mindset and optimistic expectations about the future. It is important to understand that these enviable resources are the individual's beliefs about the self, not external evaluations or objective tests of achievement or competence. Just as the negative effects of stress depend on the individual's perceived stress and the impact of temptations depends on how they are appraised and mentally represented, the potential health benefits of our abilities, achievements, and prospects depend on how we interpret and evaluate them. Think of people you know who are highly competent but sabotage themselves with their own negative self-evaluations and paralyzing self-doubts. Beliefs about the self are correlated with objective measures of competence and mastery, but far from perfectly. The impressive evidence about the importance of these beliefs for successful coping, both psychologically and biologically, keeps growing. Shelley Taylor, the founder of the field of health psychology and a professor at the University of California in Los Angeles, and her team have shown that a sense of mastery and optimistic expectations buffer the deleterious effects of stress and predict many desirable neurophysiological and psychological health-related outcomes. As Taylor and her colleagues reported in 2011 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, each belief has a substantial genetic component, but is also open to modification and influence by environmental conditions. Given the importance of these beliefs for the quality and length of life, I next consider each more closely. Mastery, perceived control. Mastery is the belief that you can be an active agent in determining your own behavior and that you are able to change, grow, learn, and master new challenges. It's the I think I can belief that George Ramirez says Kip taught him and that turned his life around. I first saw its importance when I was a trainee in the clinical psychology doctoral program at Ohio State University and watched my mentor, George A. Kelly, work with a very distressed young woman. Teresa was becoming increasingly upset and anxious, feeling that she could no longer manage her life. In the third therapy session, her agitation seemed to peak, as she exclaimed tearfully that she was afraid she was losing it, and begged Dr. Kelly to answer her question, "Am I falling apart?" Kelly slowly took off his glasses, brought his face close to hers, stared straight into her eyes and asked, "Would you like to?" Teresa was stunned. She seemed immensely relieved, as if a huge burden had dropped from her shoulders. It had not occurred to her that it might be within her power to change what she felt. Falling apart was suddenly an option, not her inevitable fate. She did not have to be the passive victim of her biography, witnessing her life unravel. This was her eureka moment. It started her exploration of alternative and more constructive ways of thinking about herself and opened courses of action she had not considered because she had thought them impossible. Carol Dweck, my colleague for many years at Columbia University, she is now at Stanford University, has become one of the most forceful and effective modern voices in psychology on the topic of perceived control and mastery beliefs. Her work, summarized in her 2006 book, Mindset, shows how people's personal theories about how much they can control, change, and learn, and how much they can improve what they do, experience, and make of themselves, influence what they actually can achieve and become. Dweck and her colleagues demonstrate that these personal theories about the malleability versus fixed state of one's characteristics matter greatly, whether in regard to self-control and willpower, intelligence, mental state, or personality. These theories change how we evaluate our performance, how we judge ourselves and other people, and how the social world in turn responds to us. Beginning early in life, some children see their intelligence, their ability to control the world around them, their sociability and other characteristics, not as fixed essences that they are either stuck with or blessed with from birth on, but more flexibly like muscles or cognitive skills that they can build and develop. Dweck calls these children incremental growth-minded theorists. Others, the entity theorists, see their abilities as frozen from birth, at some fixed level that they cannot change, smart or dumb, good or bad, powerful or helpless. Happily, Dweck's work goes beyond showing the importance of these mindsets. Her research also makes clear that mindsets are open to change and illustrates many ways to rethink and modify them. Dweck shows that children stuck with an entity theory about their own abilities tend to have a particularly difficult time when schoolwork becomes increasingly challenging. This is especially striking in the transition from elementary school to junior high school in the United States, when many schools suddenly grade competitively rather than reassuringly. The school experience shifts from fun and easy to tough and demanding, with long and hard homework and competitive peers. Dweck found that under high pressure and the threat of failure in the new school environment, the students who viewed their abilities as fixed, the entity theorists, soon began to get lower grades, doing progressively worse over the 2 years of junior high school. The students with a growth mindset, in contrast, kept getting better and better grades over those 2 years. When the two groups began junior high school, their past school records could not be distinguished. By the end, there was an obvious gap. Students with the fixed mindset justified the difficulties they were having with the tough new school demands by maligning their own abilities. I suck in math, or I'm the stupidest, or by blaming their teachers. The teacher is on crack. Those with the growth mindset also sometimes felt overwhelmed by the new demands, but they responded by digging in, figuring out what it took to master the new situation, and doing it. At the preschool level, the belief that I think I can is captured in the classic story for young children, The Little Engine That Could. A train filled with toys and treats for little boys and girls gets stuck as it's trying to get up the last steep mountain. A shiny new passenger train and a strong freight train and an old tired train pass by, all refusing to help. At last, the kind little blue engine arrives. It struggles and struggles, chanting its growth-minded theory. I think I can, I think I can, I think I can, until it ultimately prevails and delivers the gifts to the children waiting on the other side of the mountain. At Stanford in 1974, my students and I developed a scale to assess how preschoolers perceived the causes of their own behavior. Did they see themselves as the agents for the good things that happen, or did they credit external factors? And did these differences in causal attribution link to their self-control and how they were developing? In order to measure where they were in this scale of perceived internal versus external control of behavior, we asked them questions like these. When you draw a whole picture without breaking your crayon, is that because you were very careful or because it was a good crayon? When someone brings you a present, is that because you are a good girl or boy or because they like to give people presents? We then looked at how the children's answers to these questions were connected to their behavior, which was also assessed in other situations that required self-control. The bottom line from these studies was that even preschool children's belief that they could control outcomes by their own behavior was significantly linked to how hard they tried, how long they persisted, and how successful they were at self-control. The more they saw themselves as the causes of positive outcomes, the more likely they were to delay gratification on the marshmallow test, to control their impulsive tendencies, and to persist in diverse situations in which their own behavior would be instrumental in reaching the desired outcome. They believed they could do it, and they did. The child's self-perception as someone who can, who can exert effort, persist, and be the causal agent for positive outcomes, is nourished by the self-control skills that help them succeed. One could see this in the pride that some preschoolers expressed in the surprise room at Stanford when instead of just eating their treats for which they had successfully waited, they chose to bag them and take them home, eager to show their parents what they had earned. The more effectively children can wait and work for their bigger treats earlier in life, and the better the cognitive and emotional skills that enable these triumphs, the more they grow their sense of yes, I can, and ready themselves for new and greater challenges. In time, the mastery experiences and new skills they acquire, like learning to play the violin or build Lego empires or invent new computer applications, become intrinsic rewards in which the activity itself is satisfying. The children's sense of efficacy and agency becomes grounded in their experiences of success and leads to reality-based optimistic expectations and aspirations, each success increasing the chances for the next. Optimism, expectations of success. Optimism is an inclination to anticipate the best possible outcome. Psychologists define it as the extent to which individuals have favorable expectations for their future. These are expectations of what they really believe will happen, more like faith than just hope. And they're closely linked with the I think I can mindset. The positive consequences of optimism are dazzling and would be hard to believe if they were not so well supported by research. For example, Shelley Taylor and her colleagues showed that optimists cope more effectively with stress and are better protected against its adverse effects. They take more steps to protect their health and future well-being, generally stay healthier, and are less likely to become depressed compared with those who are low in optimism. Psychologist Charles Carver and his colleagues showed that when optimists have coronary bypass surgery, they recover more quickly than pessimists do. The list of benefits goes on and on. In short, optimism is a blessing to be wished for as long as it reasonably connects to reality. To appreciate optimism and see why and how it works for those who have it, consider its opposite, pessimism. Pessimism is a tendency to focus on the negative, expect the worst, or make the gloomiest interpretation possible. Show a depressed pessimist a phrase like, I really hate, followed by a blank space in which to insert the first thoughts that come to mind, and he or she is likely to insert me, or the way I look, or the way I talk. Extreme pessimists feel helpless, depressed, and unable to control their lives. They attribute the bad things that happen to them to their own stable negative qualities rather than being open to more situational and less self-condemning explanations of what went wrong. They fail a test and think, I'm incompetent, even if the test is not a valid measure of anything important. Kinder explanations, whether regarding the test itself, confusing instructions, ambiguous multiple choice options, excessive time pressure, or personal problems, an upset stomach, don't come to mind for pessimists, even if they happen to be true. Early in life, if this pessimistic explanatory style is extreme, it can be bad news for the future and can become a formula for developing serious depression. At the University of Pennsylvania, Christopher Peterson and Martin Seligman asked healthy 25-year-old college graduates to describe some of their difficult personal experiences and then examined how they explained them. The pessimists believed that things would never improve, it won't ever be over for me, and generalized broadly beyond each event to reach gloomy conclusions about diverse aspects of their lives, all of which they considered their fault. Follow-up health examinations and measures of illness for all participants during the first 20 years after college showed no significant differences in their health. Between the ages of 45 and 60, however, those who had been more pessimistic at age 25 were more likely to be ill. Researchers also analyzed newspaper interviews with ballplayers from the Baseball Hall of Fame, published throughout the first half of the last century. The interviews quoted the players' explanations as they talked about how and why they won or lost games. These players were all outstanding enough to be in the Hall of Fame, but those who saw their losses as due to their personal failings and attributed their wins to momentary external causes like the wind was right that afternoon, tended not to live as long as those who took credit for their successes. Seligman has led much of the research on optimistic versus pessimistic explanatory styles. He proposed that optimists differ from pessimists in how they perceive and explain their success and failure. When optimists fail, they think they can succeed the next time if they change their behavior or the situation appropriately. They use a rejection experience, failed job application, bad investment, or poor test result to figure out what they need to do to improve their chances on the next attempt. They then craft alternative plans and find other ways to reach their important goals or seek needed advice until they can develop a better strategy. While the optimists deal with failure constructively, the pessimists use the same experience to confirm their gloomy expectations, believing it's their fault, and they try to avoid thinking about it, assuming there is nothing they can do. Seligman says college entrance exams measure talent, while explanatory style tells you who gives up. It is the combination of reasonable talent and the ability to keep going in the face of defeat that leads to success. What you need to know about someone is whether they will keep going when things get frustrating. This is an equally apt description of the preschool kids who continue to wait during the marshmallow test. Seconds of waiting time not only measure their delay ability, but how long they wait, it also tells us how much grit the children have or how persistent they are, as the frustration of the delay and the effort needed to stick with it keep escalating. Because optimists have higher overall expectations of success, they are more willing to delay gratification, even when it is difficult to do so. Unless children expect to succeed and get those marshmallows later when the experimenter comes back, there's no reason for them to try to wait or work for them. Those who expect that they will be able to do whatever it takes to get their preferred rewards choose to wait and work for them. Those who don't, or who don't trust the experimenter, take the immediately available smaller rewards by ringing the bell. Erwin Staub escaped from communist Hungary as a young man, and in the early 1960s he became one of my first graduate students at Stanford, as well as a lifelong friend. Together we conducted experiments at Stanford to see how expectations about success influence self-control and the willingness to work and wait for delayed rewards. We found that 14-year-old eighth-grade boys, who generally expected to succeed even before they saw the specific task they would have to perform, chose to do cognitive tasks for which the larger but delayed reward was contingent on successful performance, not just on waiting. This was rather than settling for the smaller but immediate reward, and they chose this option almost twice as often as those with low success expectations. The boys with high expectations for success approached new tasks more confidently, as if they had already succeeded at them. They wanted to go for it, and they were willing to risk failure because they did not believe they would fail. Their expectations were more than fantasies. They were based on their history of previous successful experiences. Their successes fed the positive expectancies, which in turn encouraged behaviors and mindsets that increased their chances for further success. All of which makes optimists smile even more. The findings also showed that those who started with low generalized expectations began as if they had already failed at the task. But these boys did respond positively when they actually succeeded at it, and their new success experiences significantly raised their expectations for future success. Our broad expectations for success or failure crucially impact how we approach new tasks. But our specific expectations are responsive to change when we see that we can actually succeed. The message is clear. Optimists in general are better off than pessimists, but even pessimists raise their expectations when they see that they can succeed. Virtuous and vicious cycles. In sum, the successes and mastery experiences children have early in life increase how willing and able they become to pursue goals with persistence, develop optimistic expectations for success, and cope with the frustrations, failures, and temptations that are inevitable as they grow up. Their developing sense of control and agency and optimistic expectations become key links, the active ingredients in the story that connects the seconds of preschool waiting time for a couple of marshmallows to the diverse positive outcomes we see as their lives evolve. and their ability to inhibit impulsive responses that could jeopardize their building of relationships allows them to develop mutually supportive, caring friendships with people who respect and value them. This chapter described a virtuous cycle of growth to hope for and nurture in our children. It contrasts with the vicious cycle faced by children who persistently lack basic self-control skills, feel out of control, are pessimistic about their own abilities, and struggle to maintain a sense of self-worth. Without adequate self-control skills, optimistic expectations, success experiences, and the help and support of others, children may remain largely controlled by their HOT system, more likely to fail in their earliest efforts at mastery, and prone to develop feelings and mindsets of helplessness rather than hopefulness as their choices and options shrink. 9. Your future self. The ant in Aesop's fable instinctively knows what it has to do to prepare for the future, and when summer comes, it drags off the food it will need for the winter. But we don't have the ant's instincts, and evolution has not yet adapted our brain for dealing concretely with the distant future. We easily become anxious about frightening events that are imminent, but rarely visualize the future in vivid, hot terms. Those rose-colored glasses and the feel-good psychological immune system protect most of us from dwelling on such anxieties. They allow us to avoid focusing on terrifying prospects like cancer, impoverishment, lonely old age, and ill health, and if these anxieties do become vivid, most of us soon self-distract. In this way, we avoid the anxiety that Freud found in his patients, and that the painter Edvard Munch depicted in The Scream. An icon of anxiety in the modern world, the painting shows a terrified person trembling on a bridge in ominous surroundings, hands cupped against the ears, eyes wide open, staring at us from a horror-struck face. Our defenses protect us from lingering too long on such an image, but they also make it unlikely that we'll behave like provident ants rather than self-indulgent grasshoppers. Consequently, people continue taking all sorts of risks, like eating too much and smoking and drinking too heavily, ignoring the long-term consequences that are far off, uncertain, and easily discounted. The vast majority of Americans arrive at retirement age with funds completely insufficient to maintain anything remotely like the lifestyle to which they have become accustomed. The problem begins with how we naturally think about the future self and how that future self is represented in the brain. Multiple selves. Shakespeare's Seven Ages of Man famously captured the multiple selves experienced in the course of life. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. Shakespeare begins with the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms, and after describing our young and middle ages, moves on to old age. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch on side, his youthful hose well saved a world too wide, for his shrunk shank and his big manly voice turning again toward childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all that ends this strange eventful history is second childishness and mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything. The human body changes completely as we age, but does the self we experience change too? What happens when you travel through time in your imagination and think about yourself in the future? Imagine pairs of circles that move from no overlap between your current and future self to almost complete overlap. Next, visualize a pair that best depicts the degree to which you feel yourself similar and connected to the future self that you expect to be 10 years from now. Now, imagine that you have agreed to let your brain activity be imaged while you are inside an fMRI machine. Your head is deep in the machine and you are getting used to the confined space as the instructions come through the speaker. Please think about yourself. When you do, a distinctive pattern of brain activity will become visible in the midfront area of your cerebral cortex, which we'll call the self pattern. Next, the instructions ask you to think about a stranger, and in the same area of your cerebral cortex, a distinctly different pattern becomes activated, the stranger pattern. Finally, you are asked to please think about yourself 10 years from now. Hal Hirschfield, now at New York University, and his colleagues conducted this study with Stanford University undergraduates in 2009. They found that we differ not only in what we feel when we imagine our future selves, but in our brain activity. Depending on how closely we connect our self-perceptions and identity in the present to the selves we become. For many people, the pattern that becomes activated in the brain for the future self is more like the one for the stranger than like the one for the self. But there are individual differences showing that some people are more emotionally in touch and identified with their future self, while for others, that older person might as well be somebody else. How much overlap is there in the circles you visualized? If you see more continuity between yourself now and yourself in the future, you probably put more value on delayed rewards and less value on immediate rewards and are less impatient than people who view their future selves as strangers. As the researchers point out, if we feel greater continuity with who we will become, we might also be willing to sacrifice more of our present pleasures for the sake of that future self. The same group of researchers also looked at financial decision-making in adults, mean age of 54 years, living in the San Francisco Bay Area. The participants who perceived greater rather than less overlap between their present self and their future self not only had a stronger preference for delayed larger rewards, rather than immediate smaller rewards, but also accumulated more real-world assets, net worth from all sources, over time. When I read Hirschfield's research, I reminded myself to recheck the status of my retirement plan. Money now versus 401k for the future. If Adam and Eve had managed to cool the hot temptations they faced, they would have been able to hold on to their garden longer. If they had wanted to prepare for what they might face in the future, they would have had to vividly imagine themselves in it, which they could not do. The kids in the surprise room had to cool down to resist taking their one marshmallow. Decades later, when making their 401k choices, they have to imagine themselves in old age, not abstractly but concretely, in order to heat the scene emotionally as if they were already there. While they're still young, they have to linger on that future self, at least long enough to check the box on the 401k retirement form that initiates the retirement plan. Just as preschoolers' willingness and ability to wait for two marshmallows depend on how they mentally represent the treats, the young adult's ability to connect with the self-expected years in the future depends on how that distant self is mentally represented. To explore this, Hirschfield and his colleagues set out in one study to show a group of college students vivid representations of their retirement-age selves while they were making financial decisions. As a first step, the researchers asked each participant for a photo of him or herself and then created an avatar or digital representation out of that photo. For some of the participants, the avatar was of themselves at their present age. For others, the avatar was made to look older, representing the person at approximately age 68. Participants used a slider scale with an arrow to indicate what percentage of their hypothetical paycheck they would allocate toward their 401k retirement account. As they moved the arrow to the left, they increased the percent they would get as take-home pay, and as they moved the arrow to the right, they increased the percent going into their retirement fund. Participants saw either the avatar of their current self displayed on the left side of the slider or the avatar of their future self displayed on the right side of the slider. Would calling attention to the self they would become in the future influence the present self to share current income? Indeed, those who saw their future self indicated that they would save 30% more relative to those who saw their current self. The idea guiding this research is that the more emotionally connected you become to your future self, the more you will incorporate it into your present self-conception and budget, ready to share more generously from what you currently give yourself to what you allocate to yourself in the future. Hirschfeld and other researchers are continuing to explore whether savings for later years, not just in hypothetical lab situations, but in real life, specifically in 401k retirement plans, might be substantially increased by enhancing the saver's identification with the future self. Becoming ethical for the future self? If you feel closely connected to your future self, will you be more likely to take into account how your present actions will impact how you feel later, and not just when it comes to budgets and retirement planning? Specifically, will individuals who experience close continuity with their future selves be less likely to make the unethical decisions that are all too common in everyday life? It's a timely question given that FBI statistics on white-collar crime, first gathered in 1940, indicate that the rate of such crime had tripled by 2009, a problem made salient by the rash of financial scandals exposed during the 2008 financial crisis, including Bernard Madoff's monumental Ponzi scheme. In 2012, Hirschfeld and his colleagues asked that question in 5 online studies using women and men ranging in age from 18 to 72 years. The researchers inquired about their willingness to endorse unethical but profitable business decisions and their moral judgments about the acceptability of lies and bribes in business contexts. For example, how likely would the individual, always anonymous, be to market a profitable food product with known health hazards or to endorse a financially lucrative but environmentally risky mining operation that could lead to a large bonus? Across the 5 studies, people who felt more disconnected from their future selves, measured by little overlap in their circles for the present self and future self, were more apt to tolerate unethical business decisions. The researchers also prompted some participants to think about their future selves, while others were primed to think about the future world. Projecting the self into the future, compared with simply thinking about the future, reduced tolerance for unethical behavior. Those who felt closely connected to the future self thought more about the delayed long-term consequences of their actions, and it was this attention to future consequences that accounted for their unwillingness to make greedy, selfish decisions. It's a finding to recall before the HOT system, oblivious to distant consequences and blind to ethics, faces its next tantalizing but immoral temptation. 10. Beyond the here and now. Some of my more memorable conversations with colleagues about how we think about the future have been at annual science conventions, not during meetings and research presentations, but when swapping personal stories late at night. Each of us had made decisions to accept invitations to give talks 2 or 3 years in the future, at unfamiliar, interesting-sounding places. One of my colleagues told the story of her 2008 invitation to give a special lecture in 2011 in an exotic small country thousands of miles away. When she got the invitation, she asked herself, why go there? She found many good reasons. The Institute had some respected researchers working in her area. It was a new experience in an unfamiliar setting. A newspaper travel section called it remote and beautiful. She liked to travel to unusual places. Her schedule for 2011 was still wide open, and the organizers seemed very eager for her to come. 2 years later, as the time for the journey approached, her questions about the trip shifted from why she should go to how she would get there, and just what exactly she would have to do to make it happen. She had to arrange to change planes multiple times, flying with unfamiliar airlines that on closer examination had dubious safety records and bad histories for flight delays and cancellations. She had to renew her passport and get vaccinations, all while a seemingly endless series of unexpected events required her urgent attention. There was a complete shift in how my colleague thought about that trip from the time she gladly accepted the invitation to almost 3 years later as her departure date approached. This surprised her because as the future turned into the here and now, she wished she could call it off. Psychological distance. Psychologists Yaakov Tropi and Nira Lieberman propose that when we imagine the future or think about the past, we are traversing a single dimension. Psychological distance. The distance can be in time, now versus in the future or past, space, near versus far away, social, self versus strangers, and certainty, definite versus hypothetical. The greater the psychological distance, the more abstract and high-level information processing becomes, increasingly governed by the cool cognitive system. In my colleague's travel example, she had thought about the trip abstractly, without details and context in mind, when it was far off in the future. And because it had seemed reasonable and made sense to her cool system, she had decided to go. As the psychological distance shrank, the more concrete, vivid, detailed, contextualized, and emotionally hot her information processing became, and the more she regretted her decision. This shift in the level of information processing from abstract thinking about the future to concrete and vivid thinking in the present affects what we feel and how we plan, evaluate, and make decisions. It helps explain why people make decisions about future events and commitments that they often regret, because when the future becomes the present, they find themselves facing a trip they don't want to take, an event they don't want to attend, a paper they don't want to write, or a family visit they don't want to make. The good news is that all will be well if we just wait and reflect for a bit after an event is over. The psychological immune system works hard so that we can look back and feel that the trip was worth taking, the event worth attending, the paper worth writing, and the family visit, on the whole, a good bonding experience. To avoid the regret my colleague felt when her trip went from hypothetical to the reality of packing and heading off to the airport, it might have helped if before deciding to accept, she had imagined how it would play out as if it were happening now. If you want to decide how something, a new job and exotic trip, will feel in the future, you might try to imagine yourself doing it in the present. Simulate the events as vividly as possible, in great detail, by essentially pre-living them. When my graduate students are fortunate enough to have more than one job offer and are tortured about their decision, I suggest that they imagine as concretely as they can, living life in each job one full day at a time, as if the job were happening now. The research by Tropy and his colleagues on how psychological distance influences us also speaks to why it is much easier to resist immediate temptations if we think about them in abstract, cool ways, or as being far away in space and time. Such high-level abstract thinking activates the cool system and attenuates the hot system. It reduces the automatic preference for immediate rewards, increases attention to future outcomes, strengthens intentions to exert self-control, and helps cool down hot temptations. Recall that when preschoolers push the treats far away, or turn around to avoid seeing them, or appraise their tempting treats at an abstract, cool level, imagine the marshmallows are just a picture, put a frame around them in your head, they are able to control themselves and wait much longer. But when they focus on the taste of the marshmallows and imagine appetitive, salient qualities in their mouths, yummy, chewy, sweet, delay becomes more difficult, and they ring the bell. Increasing psychological distance to control craving, close versus far. Can people who are victimized by their dangerous cravings, whether for tobacco, alcohol, drugs, or fat-filled snack foods, cool them down by increasing their psychological distance? This question guided some experiments done by Kevin Oxner and his team, with which I collaborated at Columbia University. We wanted to try to help people control their cravings beginning early in life. With that goal, we invited children and adolescents aged 6 to 18 to complete a task while their brains were being scanned with fMRI. And this gave us a glimpse into how they cognitively regulated their appetitive impulses. In the scanner, pictures of appetizing foods were quickly flashed in front of them in many different trials. In hot, close trials, we asked them to imagine that the food was close, right in front of them, and to focus on the hot, appetitive features like its taste and smell. In cool, far trials, we tried to activate their cool system by asking them to imagine that the food was far away and to focus on its cool, abstract, visual features like color and shape. The participants reported that they felt less craving during the cool, far trials than during the hot, close trials, and their brain images showed that reducing their craving decreased activity in the brain regions involved in appetitive desire. Children in this study also took the marshmallow test, and their ability to control cravings for appetite of food was linked to their ability to delay on the test. Children who had not been able to wait as long for their treats experienced more craving during both cool far and hot close trials than those who could wait longer. And when they were trying to reduce their food cravings as their brains were being imaged in the scanner, the low-delay children also had less activation of the prefrontal cortex and more activation of the reward areas related to appetite of desire. Hedy Kober, who was also working with Ochsner's team, led a similar study in which she showed photographs of cigarettes to induce cravings in heavy cigarette smokers. During each trial, while their brains were being imaged, participants were instructed to think of the item they saw by focusing either on its immediate, short-term effect, now, for example, it will feel good, or on the later, long-term consequences associated with consuming it, for instance, I may get lung cancer. When heavy cigarette smokers focused on the long-term consequences of cigarette smoking, they significantly reduced their cigarette cravings. Overall, we found that people can use simple cognitive strategies to regulate their cravings by shifting their time perspective from now to later. You can turn such strategies into specific if-then implementation plans like those discussed in Chapter 5, so that the temptation to smoke automatically activates your focus on the delayed negative consequences, making them hot and vivid enough to stifle the craving. An addicted smoker's self-generated cure. The Columbia studies tell us something about the mechanics of craving regulation that seems promising for real-life applications. But if it is really so simple, then why does the world still have such massive and costly problems with cravings? In research studies, the participants are volunteers who are willing to comply with the instructions and regulate their thinking accordingly, at least while in the laboratory. In the real world, it is, of course, a much more complicated story, as every addict who has tried to quit understands. Carl Jung was reported to have said that people study what they are not good at themselves. This applies to me quite often. I am not a model of self-control, far from it. But I did have success in my struggle to overcome cigarette cravings. I tell my story here to show that even someone who is not broadly good at using this skill and who often stresses his students and family with his impatience can do it. I began to tentatively puff on cigarettes as an adolescent, and it wasn't long before I became a habitual heavy smoker. When the U.S. Surgeon General's report on tobacco risks came out in the early 1960s, my cool system briefly registered that smoking could result in serious long-term damage, and my hot system paid no attention. The cool system is rational, but it can also work closely with the hot system in the service of self-defense to cleverly rationalize whatever we do. In my case, it did an excellent job letting me reappraise my smoking as just part of the lifestyle of an academic, rather than a life-threatening addiction. I was a professor whose smoking allowed him to give less anxious, more thoughtful lectures. And everybody else was doing it anyway. So I kept chain smoking while my cool system slept and my hot system enjoyed and coughed. One morning I was in the shower with the water running before I realized that my lit pipe was still in my mouth. Denial was no longer possible. I was an addict and I craved tobacco. At that point, I was smoking about 3 packs of cigarettes a day and supplementing that with a pipe. My insight produced no behavior change. Instead, it just increased my stress level. My cool system kept busy with other concerns. Not long after that shower, I was walking through the halls of Stanford University's medical school and saw a sight that terrified me. A man was being wheeled down the hall, strapped to a gurney. His eyes were wide open, staring at the ceiling, and his arms were stretched out at his sides. There were little green pen marks all over his exposed chest and on top of his shaved head. A nurse explained that the patient had metastasized cancer and was being taken for another radiation session. The green marks were there to direct the radiation. I could not shake that vivid image of the consequences of my addiction from my mind. The Surgeon General's findings had finally penetrated my hot system and sounded the amygdala alarm. Cigarettes were my continuous hot temptation, and I had to change them into something that disgusted me in order to cure my addiction. Whenever I felt a craving, at first this was often, I inhaled deeply from a large can filled with old stale cigarette butts and pipe debris. The can had a concentrated nicotine odor intense enough to be nauseating. The textbooks call this aversive counterconditioning. I supplemented this step by deliberately reactivating that haunting image of the cancer patient to make the later consequences of smoking as hot, salient, and vivid for myself as possible. Perhaps just as important, I made a social contract with my 3-year-old thumb-sucking daughter. She agreed to stop sucking her thumb, and I vowed to stop sucking my pipe. I also made public commitments with my co-workers and students, contracting myself to quit cigarettes and no longer mooch them. It took a few weeks of struggle, but ultimately it worked. I still find that my hot system occasionally seats me at a table near a smoker in outdoor cafes. But after inhaling for a few moments, I almost always try to change my seat. Visualizing yourself as a cancer patient being prepared for the next radiation treatment is anything but fun, and it makes your amygdala go wild with fear. But if your cool system wants to try it, it can be useful. This kind of visualization can be one step in conquering life-threatening addictions with deadly consequences that do not play out until much later, but whose prevention requires immediate self-control and delay of gratification. It demands doing exactly what does not come naturally, activating the hot system to make representations of the future more powerful than temptations of the present, and then using the cool system to cognitively reappraise the immediate temptations in ways that neutralize them or make them aversive within the hot system. At first, it is effortful, but in time, it becomes automatic. Peeking into your DNA future. Taking the future into account in the decisions we make in the present requires imagining that future and predicting what it will feel like. Until late in the last century, attempts to predict the future were largely restricted to palm reading, tarot cards, astrology charts, soothsayers, and prophets. In Western history, future prediction dates from as early as the ancient Greek legends about the Oracle at Delphi, all the way to modern science fiction fantasies and fortune cookies. But in today's world, the cracking and decoding of the human genome lets us at last peek into our own DNA, which can be exciting to optimists but terrifying to pessimists. Soon you will likely be able to get a full report of the good and bad prospects that are waiting to unfold in your genes for a fee no greater than that for a colonoscopy. That can be wonderful if you suffer from certain kinds of cancers or other diseases, offering the possibility of genetically targeted, individualized treatments based on your DNA that promise to overcome previously intractable medical problems. In such cases, getting the test may be an unambiguous choice. For most healthy people, however, whether or not to do such testing will be a wrenching decision, one in which the hot system will be overactive and the cool system will have a very hard time trying to help make a reasonable choice. In the late 1990s, soon after the discovery of mutations in the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes and their role in breast and ovarian cancer, many women faced a difficult decision. The choice to undergo testing for these mutations is particularly torturous because the psychological impact is likely to be both profound and unpredictable. Genetic testing can tell the population of people most vulnerable to these mutations that they either have a much greater chance of developing breast and/or ovarian cancer early in life, or that they are in the lucky group unlikely to face such prospects. When the tests became available, many women were eager to get them, especially young Jewish Ashkenazi women, because they were in the population most likely to have the mutations. For many, the conflict about whether or not to find out what the future holds becomes unbearable. Do you take the test to learn whether you will probably develop cancer and discover that the same genetic shadow is likely to hang over your family and children? Do you decline to open this new window into your medical future? If you do open it, there is no way to close it again, and you have to live with the emotional and practical consequences for you and those you care most about. That includes the fact that this information will become part of your medical record with unclear implications, even for your employment prospects. Irma was a vibrant young graduate student, full of hope for her future, happy in her studies, in love with her boyfriend, looking forward to a wonderful life, when she learned that she carried the BRCA1 mutation that she inherited from her mother. She had thought that it would be good to get the information, so she had decided to be tested, but then found herself tortured by the results, miserable to be stuck with them, filled with regrets that she had opened the window into her double helix, wishing she did not know what she now could not put out of her mind. When she got the test results telling her that she carried the mutation, she fell apart. She simply had not known ahead of time that she really did not want to know what her DNA contained, and that she would be devastated by what she learned. Irma was not alone in her inability to predict how she would react to the test results. Can people be helped before they make their decision to better anticipate what they are likely to feel when they get the results of such genetic testing? That requires somehow pre-living the experience, and not with the unemotional, abstract, rational, and cool information processing we normally use for the distant future, but instead with the emotional processing we give to highly arousing experiences in the here and now. Adequately informed consent is rarely obtained when people are wearing hospital gowns and ID bracelets being prepped for the operating room early the next morning. Before surgery, somebody comes around with a clipboarded document full of small print that describes in much detail in medical jargon the multiple risks. This document makes it clear that just about everything could go wrong. You sign to agree that you won't blame the hospital and that you are undertaking the procedure of your own volition with fully informed consent. While there is little choice for medical interventions that are considered essential, it is a different situation for elective procedures like genetic testing. In the early 1990s, I consulted with psychologist Suzanne M. Miller at the Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia to develop a method that would improve informed consent for DNA testing. Suzanne and her colleagues were working with people at high risk for carrying the BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations, and most of these people were eager and anxious for genetic testing to determine their risk for breast and ovarian cancer. Most, however, did not appreciate how the knowledge of their genetic predispositions might affect them. The usual genetic counseling practiced at that time involved an empathic but standard rational discussion of the alternatives, the options, the objective risks, and the uncertainties associated with each possible outcome and choice. In the pre-living scenarios we developed for women considering genetic testing for their breast and ovarian cancer risk, we wanted each person to be able to anticipate her emotional reactions to the DNA revelations, not just abstractly, but by role-playing the experience as vividly, fully, and realistically as possible with the genetic counselor. We wanted to give these women an opportunity to anticipate and pre-live at least a mini version of their likely hot reactions to the different test outcomes. We proposed the following program. When a woman who is considering the test comes in for genetic counseling, she engages in realistic role play with her counselor. The counselor tells her that the test results have come back from the lab, opens the folder on the desk, and reads that the results are positive. She has the mutation. In the safe, supportive environment with the counselor, she has the chance to express her feelings and thoughts, which might range from shock and disbelief to intense anxiety, despair, denial, anger, and questioning of the results. After these concerns are expressed and discussed, the counselor helps the woman begin to examine the options that are available and their likely consequences. Options include prophylactic mastectomy for the BRCA1 mutation and prophylactic removal of the ovaries in the case of BRCA2. This candid pre-living experience goes on to deal with the long-term practical consequences affecting duration and quality of life, health care, insurance, employment, and personal relationship prospects, childbearing, and any other concerns that arise. This hot role-play experience is inevitably painful, but it gives the participant the emotional preview as well as the cognitive information, to make a truly informed decision about whether or not to open the new genetic Pandora's box. The role play also includes the happier scenario in which the genetic testing results are negative, and those implications are explored with equal depth and detail. After absorbing and reflecting on these pre-lived experiences, the decision to do or not to do the testing becomes the individual's well-informed choice. As genome analysis and effective molecular science approaches to individually oriented diagnosis, prevention, and treatment continue to develop, decisions about looking into specific DNA prospects will become part of life for many. When these possibilities become realities, reaching wise decisions and giving informed consent about the range of preventive actions ideally should be guided by both the head and the heart, by the cool system and the hot system working together. The challenge will be to pre-live the emotions while also thinking coolly and proactively about what needs to be done. What do you and don't you want to know about your future? We differ enormously in how much we want to know about the risks and dangers we face. Imagine that while waiting in the doctor's office for a routine checkup, you're greeted by a medical researcher who wants you to answer a few questions. She asks you to vividly imagine scenes like this one. You are on an airplane 30 minutes from your destination when the plane unexpectedly goes into a deep dive and then suddenly levels off. After a short time, the pilot announces that nothing is wrong, although the rest of the ride may be rough. You, however, are not convinced that all is well. In the airplane situation, would you listen carefully to the engines for unusual noises and watch the crew to see if their behavior is out of the ordinary? Or would you watch the end of the movie, even if you had seen it before? The questionnaire doesn't disguise what the researcher is asking. Do you want to know more about the stress you are facing or less? Another scenario runs as follows. You are afraid of the dentist and have to get some dental work done. During the procedure, would you want him to tell you what he is doing, or prefer to do mental puzzles in your head? People who want to know more are characterized as monitors. Those who would rather not know and prefer to self-distract or suppress are blunters. Women who are about to have a colposcopy, a common diagnostic procedure to check for the presence of abnormal, cancerous cells in the uterus, were given the monitoring blunting questionnaire while waiting to undergo the procedure, and they were then divided into two groups, monitors and blunters. In each group, half were given extensive information about the procedure they faced, and half got the standard minimal information before they signed the typical consent form. The women reported what they felt before, during, and after the procedure. And the doctor, as well as observers who were blind to all the other information, assessed their psychophysiological reactions, including pulse, muscle tension, hand clenching, and expressions of pain and discomfort. Blunters who received minimal information and monitors who received extensive information experienced the least tension and stress during the exam and in the recovery period. Thus, when the amount of preparatory information they received fit their preferences, the women fared best and experienced the least stress. These findings suggest that physicians should consider asking their patients how much they want to know about the medical options and decisions they face and the possible risks and benefits each choice entails. And in medical situations, you might want to think about when you do or don't want to know more about the risks and side effects detailed in those consent forms or buried in tiny print in the warnings packed with each prescription drug. When do you want to monitor and when do you want to blunt? When facing stress, whether medical or social, monitors generally do better when they are told more, and blunters do better when they are told less. Matching the information to the individual's style reduces stress. As with all measures of individual differences, some people fall on either extreme of the spectrum, but most are more or less in the middle range. As a general rule for most people, if there is nothing you can do to reduce the stress because the situation is out of your control, monitoring typically increases anxiety and stress, and blunting tends to be more adaptive and self-protective. Looking back and ahead. It is a long journey from waiting for marshmallows in preschool to deciding how much current income goes into a retirement plan, overcoming cravings that threaten future health, and making well-informed medical decisions in the face of uncertain long-term consequences. But there is a common theme that connects the self-control challenges faced in all these diverse decisions over a lifetime. To resist a temptation, we have to cool it, distance it from the self, and make it abstract. To take the future into account, we have to heed it, make it imminent and vivid.